I'm Niall Capello, and this is a Vespucci story.
I remember we were out playing and we were pretending that, we'd been transported through time and space, and all of a sudden we were on this other planet and it started snowing and the night was coming and we didn't know the area. And, you know, he just kind of took over and he's like, okay, we're going to build an igloo. And, you know, he was just, he was so much fun. I don't know if this sounds goofy, but you know those little fuzz balls? They made them for like a foot bath, a foot fuzzy. And I had just this big plastic bucket thing. And I remember us playing with them, putting our feet in it and putting one in there. And he just loved that. He just thought that was the funnest thing. And one of my favorite ones is, I remember he used to love to read Garfield cartoons. He just loved them. We used to love to go to bookstores, and it was fun. You know, it's like you could pick out two books today or whatever. And he really liked that. I mean, I keep those memories very much alive, and I work very hard to do that.
In 1997, Julie Ray was a 28-year-old single mother living in Lawrenceville, Illinois, with her 10-year-old son, Joel.
I was a doctoral student getting going on my dissertation, and I had a good outlook for Joel and I. There was anticipation on my part that I would be in higher academia and that would open doors for him. He was just very, very gifted and very genuine and very loving.
But in the early hours of October 13th, 1997, Joel was brutally murdered in their home. His mother, Julie, can't talk about that day.
That is when I fall into the abyss, and I can't handle that, I know.
My name is Ron Safer, and I'm a lawyer. Julie awoke at about 4:30 in the morning to a sound. And you know, if you've woken from a sound sleep and you hear something, and she got up and she looked across to Joel's bed in the next room across the hall, and she couldn't see him on the bed. And so she isn't understanding what's going on, but she starts walking towards his bedroom to see where he is, and bam, she bangs into somebody who had been crouching in the hallway there. He's in black, he's got a hood. She can't figure out what's going on. She just grabs onto his legs, and he drags her along the rug. He breaks free and goes out into the garage, and then there's another glass back door. He can't get that glass back door opened, and she grabs him again around the waist and slides down to his knees to try and tackle him, because she is thinking, okay, he must be working with somebody else because he doesn't have Joel. Joel's not in his bed. Somebody else must have Joel. But if I hold him, I can get help. That's as clearly as she's thinking anyway. He breaks the glass in the back garage door. She is dragged across that glass. She gets out in the backyard. She's still clutching to his legs, won't let go. He finally turns around, grabs her head, smashes it down into the ground, and then walks off. She comes to, she runs directly to a neighbor's house. She says, Joel's gone, call the police. Julie, of course, is hysterical. The police show up very, very quickly. Joel has been pushed off the bed, so his body is on the ground between the wall and the bed. That's why Julie couldn't see him. And he feels a faint pulse, so he calls for the paramedics. The paramedics come in, and they feel that his body is warm, so it's just happened. But, you know, they cannot revive him. He's been stabbed 15, 16 times, and he dies.
Julie, black eye and cuts from broken glass, tells the police what happened.
They were like, you know, we want to talk to her and we're going to talk to her alone. And I know there was a minister there who said she should not be in there by herself. And I was just giving them everything I could think of, every random thought that was going through my head. And they weren't really listening to me. I could tell that. I knew that. They were just writing stuff down, but it wasn't, they weren't listening to me. They weren't hearing what I was saying. And I remember begging them to listen to me and feeling like I was just completely being ignored. And that's the main feeling I had from day one.
Soon, Julie would realize why the police didn't seem to be listening. On October 13th, 2000, Julie was charged with the first-degree murder of her son, Joel.
I didn't understand that. I didn't get it. I had no clue that they would think I did this.
There is no question in my mind that they immediately, they, the police, immediately assumed it was Julie. Why they did that? Probably for the same reason that the initial jury questioned it. Like, who does this? Who breaks into a house, kills a kid, doesn't kill the adult, doesn't steal anything, doesn't bring a murder weapon, uses a murder weapon from the house? Nobody does that. Who else is there? Julie. So they assumed from the very first moment that it was her. How do we know that? We know that because they didn't fingerprint the house. They didn't fingerprint the house because they knew that Julie's fingerprints would be all over the house. They didn't fingerprint the area around the knife block from which the knife was taken to stab Joel. They did not save the fibers on the blanket over Joel. Indeed, there's a picture of the state police officers holding the blanket up so that it can be photographed. Meanwhile, of course, all of the fibers are lost. There's a hair that is in Joel's hand that is not Julie's that they don't test. I mean, they don't test any of that. They don't fingerprint. They don't look for that evidence because they believe, they assume from the first moment it's Julie. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Once police formed a theory about what happened, the case was built around proving it.
So first, they had to try to create a motive. And they did that through Julie's ex-husband, who was an angry man. It was not an amicable divorce. He's angry that his son is killed. He's angry at the world. He's angry at Julie. And he says some things that just are demonstrably not true. For example, that she never wanted the baby and that she wanted or thought about an abortion, which is completely absurd because as her medical records show, she had a difficult pregnancy. She had to be on bed rest for months. And she did that because she desperately wanted a child. So they had to create a motive. They bent evidence. And then they had this blood spatter expert, Englert, who came into the court. He threw around fake blood, doing demonstrations of blood spatter. He took over the courtroom, and then he testified in what is the most horrific expert testimony that I've seen in my career, that the blood spatter evidence proved that Julie was guilty, and the jury believed him. You are taught, I was taught, follow the evidence. Never start with a person and then fit the evidence to that person. And that's exactly what you see in every wrongful conviction case. When you get a prosecutor who, in my view, doesn't care about whether the person he's prosecuting is innocent or guilty, but is very talented as a trial lawyer, when you get an expert who is, in my view, completely unethical, immoral, and wrong, And you get an overwhelmed defense attorney who didn't put Julie on the stand. You get an innocent woman convicted.
When cops operate this way, they get the wrong people a lot. And they recreate statistics that are inaccurate to begin with. So they have an erroneous statistic that they created, and now they reinforce it. Who was going to be home with Joel that night? It was like 3 o'clock, 4 o'clock in the morning. I was going to be with him. Where else would I be? So of course I'm the easiest person to go for.
On March 4th, 2002, Julie was convicted of her son's murder. She was sentenced to 65 years in prison.
First, I wasn't allowed to be in shock. I mean, that's what happens first. You know, you're just completely in shock. And then you're not allowed to grieve. And that went on for years. I mean, I don't think I really got to grieve for at least 10 years because of the trauma.
As Julie began her 65-year prison sentence, the outside world moved on. But life for Julie would never be the same.
I mean, I knew that someday, you know, I believed, I hoped, I prayed that the truth would come out.
My name is Diane Fanning. I'm a crime writer. I write true crime and mystery novels.
Diane was a mother of two who'd recently moved to Texas with her husband. At the time, she was writing her first book about a serial killer named Tommy Lynn Sells.
I had some manuscripts I had written, but I'd never had a book published. And I had been seeking an agent, and I did not get one until I sent her a chapter involving the Sells case. And after 2 years of work, I overnight got an agent. So I wrote to Sells and told him what I was doing and told him I'd like to speak with him. And as luck would have it, he'd been in the Bexar County Jail in San Antonio for 9 months and had not had one single visitor, so he was eager to see someone. And so he said I could come in and talk to him, and I did. And it was difficult getting to the point where he would open up, because at first, really, his main focus was for me to give him money. And then his main focus was for me to talk dirty to him. And finally, we got around to serious business. And I interviewed him, a little over 20 times. He considered me his friend. And for a while, I was the only one he would talk to about anything. He wouldn't talk to cops or anybody. And he used me as a go-between with lots of different people, police officers and victims' family members and stuff. And I, my feelings for him were so jumbled up. I mean, I could sit there sometimes and laugh at his jokes and then get out of there and feel sick because I had done that. And then at other times, he would try his best to make me get grossed out or appalled. It was all I could do not to be judgmental, and sometimes it slipped through, but I knew I had to guard against it or he'd stop talking to me. And I really found him to be the most evil person I'd ever encountered in my life. But on top of that, when he told me about his mother turning him over to a pedophile when he was 7 years old, I cried. It was just awful. To think your mother would willingly turn you over to someone who would molest you like that, and I felt so bad for that poor little boy. That didn't excuse anything the adult did, but that little boy broke my heart.
In the spring of 2002, an episode of 2020 focused on Joel's murder aired across the United States.
And so I was home alone, it was like 10 at night, and I was just scanning through the channels, seeing what was on. And something caught my eye on 2020 when I went there, and I just started listening to it. And really, when I first start listening, I'm going, yeah, right. Everybody's innocent. We all know this, you know. So, you know, her parents and her friends and her lawyers, and then finally Julie herself saying she didn't kill her son. And I was Miss Skeptic sitting there watching it, not buying it at all. And then the prosecutor came on saying things that I knew were not true. Most particularly, he said, no one comes into your home, picks up a weapon, and uses it to kill someone in the house. Now, I know that Sells had done that many times. And I asked him about that once, and he said, well, you know, you can set me down in any room, and I can find at least 3 or 4 items to kill someone with. He said, they're everywhere. And that really impressed me when I was watching that show. And by the time we got to the end, I was going, you know what? This woman just might not be guilty. She might be innocent. And someone like Sells just might have killed her son. So after I finished watching the show, I sat down and wrote a letter to Sells the next day. When I first read the letter I got from Sells, I assumed I had read it wrong, but my hands started shaking just the same. So I read it again, and then I started pacing.
When Diane wrote to Tommy Lynn Sells about the 2020 episode, she mentioned the misinformed prosecutor as a conversation point, an attempt to find common ground. She had no idea what he would say in his response.
I didn't tell him Julie's name. I didn't tell him the name of the town. I didn't tell him the dates. None of that. And he wrote back and said, was that maybe right after the girl I killed in Springfield? Was that maybe on the 13th of the month? Well, I didn't know Joel's date offhand, so I went and looked that up, and sure enough, it was on the 13th, and I double-checked the date on Stephanie Mahaney's murder, and that was, I think, on the 10th, just 3 days before. So at first, I wanted to know from him, who told you about this? So I wrote back to him, and he got a little bit miffed at me and said, nobody told me about this. You know I don't have TV, which I did know, and he said, there are a lot of murders out there that I did, and there's a lot of people sitting behind bars for crimes I committed, and I don't care. I was rocked to my core. I was very close to the panic state because I felt like this was important. I didn't want to blow it. A woman's life is hanging in the balance here. So I reached out to 2020, and the producer called me back. And we talked about it, and she said, you just don't have enough. I spent weeks trying to figure out, do I put this in the book or do I leave it out? I was afraid I'd be ridiculed, I'd be destroying my own career, but I also knew that I couldn't live with myself if I had information that might free an innocent woman, if I kept that information to myself. That's why I decided to just go ahead and go with it. And let the rocks come from whatever direction they come from. You know, I just can't do anything except write. I mean, that's what I do. I hoped that if what he was telling me was true, someone who knew more than I did would be able to take that information and make something out of it. And one of the people that saw it was Julie's mother. And she emailed me and asked me if I would talk to Julie's appeal attorney, which I said, of course. Then she emailed me again and asked me if I would talk to the investigator for the Innocence Project. And I said, sure. And suddenly I was sucked up into the case.
Diane Fanning, who is writing a book on a death row inmate, she says he has committed 50 murders across the United States, 6 or so of which were just like that, where he goes into a house without a murder weapon, kills a child and leaves without harming an adult. In fact, he's on death row for doing it in a trailer where the parents do not wake up after he slits one girl's throat and then molests another and stabs her, although she survives. So he writes back and says, was it in Illinois and was it 2 days before Stephanie Mahaney? On October 15th, 1997, Tommy Lynn Sells raped and murdered a little girl named Stephanie Mahaney in Springfield, Missouri. On October 13th, 1997, he murdered Joel. She writes back and says, yes, how do you know? And he says, because I did it.